The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about pessimistic dogs. How do they measure that, Dave?
Well, Rob, what they do is they put dogs in a room and they put them behind a screen that they can see through. And they stick a bowl at one of two sides of the room. If it's on one side, it always has food in it. And it's on the other side, it never has food in it. And then they let the dog go. And after a series of trials, the dogs come to realize, hey, if the bowl's, say, always on the left side of the room, it's going to have food. And if it's always on the right side of the room, it's going to be empty. And then what they do is they start mixing things up a little bit. They start putting the bowl maybe in the middle of the room, and then they let the dogs go. And the dogs that rush towards that bowl are considered optimistic because they go, well, I don't know if this has food or not, but I'm hoping that it does. But other dogs just sort of sigh or lay down or maybe very slowly make their way to that other bowl, indicating that they're pessimistic, that they believe that that bowl probably doesn't have food in it and it's not worth their time. And actually, researchers use very similar things, though not with food in bowls. They use very similar experiments to test whether humans are optimistic or pessimistic.
Why are researchers trying to figure out whether dogs are pessimistic or not?
Great question. Well, the reason is because researchers actually want to find out why about a third of dogs become very anxious when their owners leave home. You probably heard this. If you have a dog or if your neighbor has a dog, you leave for the day and your dog starts whining, or while you're away at work, your dog pees on the floor or tears up your slippers. These are considered anxious behaviors because the dog's very stressed out, very worried that you're gone. And the researchers in this study wanted to see if they could find a way to predict whether shelter dogs, dogs that get adopted, will be also these anxious dogs that misbehave when their owners are away.
So could researchers tell with just this one test whether a dog from a shelter would have behavioral problems after being adopted?
Well, the first thing researchers found was that they could tell whether, or at least they say they could tell whether a dog was optimistic or pessimistic. But in the next set of experiments, they wanted to find out whether that correlated with these dogs also being anxious. So they took the same dogs and they stuck them in a room alone as if they had gone away for the day. And what happened, as you might expect, is a certain fraction of the dogs became very anxious. They barked, they whined. The researchers found that these anxious dogs also tended to be the dogs that were judged to be pessimistic by the other experiment. So they conclude based on that, that pessimistic dogs or dogs that tend to have maybe a negative outlook on life also tend to be anxious dogs.
Did researchers investigate any other traits?
Well, not in this study, Rob, but one outside expert points out that this study may be not a simple black and white between optimistic and pessimistic. He thinks dogs actually have very complex personalities, maybe not as complex as we do, but much more complex than just saying a dog is optimistic and pessimistic. He thinks what's actually happening here is the dogs that are being called pessimistic are actually neurotic, which is a much more complex trait, which involves elements of pessimism and anxiety. But there's a lot more going on when you call somebody or some animal neurotic than if you just call it optimistic or pessimistic. So he says, you know, it's a cool study. It shows this link that we didn't know before, but it also shows something about dog personality that we didn't really know before.
Sounds like a really simple test. Is this something that somebody could set up in their own home?
Well, I think you could probably set up the optimism pessimism test in your own home, but I think the neuroticism would be a little bit harder to test.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, pessimism is often described as seeing the glass of water half empty. And speaking of water, this next story is all about water being a lot more complicated than we thought.
How so?
Well, our researchers already knew on some level that water is actually pretty complicated. Water can form 15 different kinds of ice. It's necessary for all life on Earth, meaning that water was very important for the first proteins forming, for DNA forming. Every living creature would not be here without water. So we know, you know, despite water's reputation as being sort of a dull liquid, it's actually a very important and potentially a very complicated liquid. But on the molecular level, we really don't have a good sense of what's going on. So in this new study, researchers really wanted to probe down to the molecular interactions that happen between water molecules. And they did this by doing a computer simulation, and they used the same sort of mathematical models that researchers have used to study other very complicated systems like the internet or the spread of viruses. And what they found is that even though water seems pretty ordinary on the surface, there's actually a sort of molecular party going on at the atomic level. What these researchers saw was that water molecules tend to form two types of molecular structures. One's this blobby, loosely packed agglomeration, and the other one is this tight, regular arrangement resembling a crystal lattice. But these structures only exist for fractions of a second, femtoseconds, Rob, which is essentially very, very, very short time scales. And what was happening in these femtosecond timescales is these structures are forming, they're breaking apart. The end result is this really chaotic mix of water molecules. And it's not just this chaotic mix, there's really sort of other unusual structures forming in these fractions of a second. You've got the hydrogen atoms in water, as everybody knows, water is two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom, forming something that almost looks like a hook onto which carbon, which is essential for all life and part of DNA and proteins and everything else, can potentially latch onto, which would give simple structures the scaffolding to become much more complicated structures and eventually complex organic molecules.
So it's thought this natural jostling of water molecules would actually help complex organic molecules form.
Exactly.
Why a computer model? Why not visualize it directly?
It's really hard to study something that happens so quickly in the real world, and that's why the researchers needed these really complex simulations. But that's actually one of the critiques of the work, is that, you know, these researchers may be oversimplifying things by just studying these water molecules with a computer model, and you're really not going to know what's going on with water until we're actually able to observe the water molecules themselves rather than just representing them on a computer. But it's a start.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, speaking of water, this last story is about creatures that live in water, fish, and how the rate at which fish decay could be very important for understanding evolution.
Different fish decay at different rates?
Well, it's not necessarily that different fish decay at different rates, but it's that different parts of a fish decay at different rates. Rob, the study has all to do with some of the challenges in looking at the fossil record. You know, archaeologists, scientists, they look at the fossil record, they trace the evolution of creatures over millions of years by looking at what, you know, new structures that are appearing in these creatures or structures that are disappearing. But the problem is a lot of a creature's original anatomy doesn't fossilize. It's really only the bones that fossilize. The soft tissues like skin and nerves, muscles, things like that, they don't fossilize. So if you're looking at an ancient creature and you're going, well, it seems to be missing this, this, and this part, well, maybe it wasn't. Maybe it's just that those parts didn't fossilize. So that's been a really big challenge. And this new study researcher said, well, you know, one of the really important things that we study in evolutionary biology is fish, because fish have changed so much and they really give us clues to how more complicated organisms may have evolved. And so what they did, which they themselves admit was a very stinky experiment, was they took two types of fish and watched them decay.
Which two fish did they choose and why?
Well, Rob, they focused on lampreys and hagfish. And the reason they focused on these fish is these fish are actually thought to be amongst the most primitive forms of fish. They may tell us a lot about what fish used to look like, or at least what these classes of fish used to look like millions of years ago. So they took the fish out of the water, they put them in the laboratory, and they basically allowed them to decay for 200 days.
That does sound stinky.
Exactly. And one of the researchers says he didn't get very many visitors to his lab during these experiments.
So what did they find?
Well, what the researchers found was, as they expected, a lot of these parts of the fish decayed very rapidly. Some structures completely disappeared over this 200-day period. And if you're trying to tie that to the fossil record, if these fish were somehow fossilized, all of a sudden, you know, somebody studying these fish millions of years from now would go, well, hey, that fish didn't have X, Y, and Z structure. And in fact, what happened is these structures just very quickly decayed. For example, certain parts of their brain and their mouths decayed. And you can imagine these are very important structures for understanding how a creature evolved.
Did researchers pick up any patterns between the two different types of fish and how they respectively decayed?
Well, they did find that certain parts decayed much faster than the other. And in fact, the parts that decayed the fastest were those parts that had evolved the most recently. And so again, you could be dealing with real problems if you're trying to interpret the fossil record, and the parts that you're most concerned about, you know, when did this part evolve, it's missing, and you just assume it hadn't evolved yet. So the main point is that we have to be very careful when we look at the fossil record. Just because the structure is not there doesn't mean it hadn't evolved yet.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about how love fights pain, how just thinking about somebody you care about can reduce physical pain. And also a story about wacky pitches in baseball, curveballs and other types of balls that seem to suddenly change direction in midair. Researchers have analyzed what they say is just an optical illusion. And on Science's policy blog, Science Insider, we've got a story about the first embryonic stem cell trial starting in the United States. This trial is to treat spinal cord injury, and the researchers have just recruited their first patient. And another origin story, this one about a super laser that's just beginning its experiments. You can check out all of these stories on the site.
David Graham is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the Science Policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.